Now for agribusiness news, markets, and weather from Studio C. This is Agriculture Today.
We just issued the Water in the West Working Lands document at USDA, which is going to drive our efforts in terms of drought in the West.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack testifying before Senate Ag Committee Thursday.
We've identified six major challenges that producers face, everything from forecasting to precision utilization of irrigation, and 13 different strategies that we're going to provide resources. Again, the Inflation Reduction Act and the conservation resources that are in that act can help fund that. And so we're interested, and we've also recently announced $25 million towards the Water Smart Initiative that Department of Interior has in terms of drought. So there is a specific focus on drought coming out of the USDA.
This is Agriculture Today.
So the USDA created the Meat and Poultry Processing Expansion Program to expand small and regional meat processing to bolster supply chain resiliency.
On Thursday, Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack testifying before the Senate Ag Committee in a USDA oversight hearing and answering a question from Iowa Senator Joni Ernst.
And as you've described, quote, "will give farmers and ranchers a fair chance to compete in the marketplace," end quote. So thus far, grants totaling $157 million have been awarded. So that's a good thing. We've got grants going out the dollar or out the door. Three of the largest grants total $69 million. Which comprised nearly half of the funds awarded. Now, again, a lot of money's gone out the door. We think that's a good thing, but nearly half of it has only gone to three projects who are privately owned by some of the wealthiest people in the United States. One of the projects in Nebraska is owned by a man on the Forbes billionaires list. Another in Idaho is owned by the wealthiest man in the state of Idaho. And a project in South Carolina is being awarded to a privately held family business with production in five states. And hey, I have no objection to families succeeding and owning, you know, a lot of businesses, and I wish them great success. But what I find problematic is that taxpayer dollars are being doled out as free grants to billionaires, while applications from farmer-owned startups like Cattlemen's Heritage in southwest Iowa and West Liberty Foods Expansion are deemed unworthy through these grants. So, Mr. Secretary, what is the criteria that has been used by USDA to determine who is getting grants, and why are we seeing that billionaires are being awarded those grants over smaller-owned startups?
Well, Senator, first of all, the Iowa project you mentioned is actually on the list that's currently under review. And we're in the process of finishing the environmental review that is required under NEPA before grants can be issued. So just be patient. I think you're going to find that that is a project that merits additional investment. That's going to be forthcoming. The level of investment is based on the application that people submitted. Some of these plants are very small. A Charles City plant, for example, very small, needed $8 million, and we provided it. A Cherokee plant needed several million dollars. We provided it. So Iowa's received several grants already, and I anticipate and expect they're going to receive at least one more for sure. And then there's the circumstance of the second round of resources. So the criteria is based on independently owned, that they're not the part of the big four packing operations. We obviously are investing in farmer-owned cooperatives that are in processing. We are very conscious of where the need is based on the consolidation of livestock operations and a livestock that's being raised. And so we're trying to make sure that we are doing a good job of spreading this out in a way that actually meets the market demand and provides these producers more than one market. We're excited about this. We think the 31 projects we funded already are good projects and are going to expand market opportunities, but we have not stopped. There are going to be more. For sure, there are going to be more, a lot more.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
We issued a seed report this week because we understand and appreciate some of the challenges that farmers have with reference to seed and seed technology and the cost of seed.
Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack was talking to farmers recently at Commodity Classic.
We established a report, More and Better Choices for Farmers, focusing on seed innovation and other inputs. And in that seed report, we took three actions. We've created a liaison between the Department of Agriculture and farmers and breeders so that you all will have input as folks are interested in establishing patent protection, which oftentimes is designed initially to provide and to promote innovation, but can be used in a way to stifle it. Now, this liaison is going to make sure that farmer input, farmer concerns, farmer awareness is heightened as these applications for patents are reviewed. We've established a working group with the Patent Trade Office, and that working group is going to work with the Department of Justice and the Federal Trade Commission to make sure that as patents are being considered, that we look at the impact of them from a regional perspective. As you well know, when you're purchasing seed, sometimes you're purchasing seed with multiple traits. Some of those traits very important to your region, but oftentimes there are traits that aren't necessarily needed on your farm. It's sort of like your cable vision bill, where you're paying for 500 channels, 490 of which you'll never watch. The question is, why are we paying for the traits that we don't absolutely need? This working group is going to make sure that your input in all of this is considered. And we put a notice to trade out, encouraging folks to provide information about the variety and type of seed being sold as quickly as possible to the farmer and to the businesses selling to the farmer, so that you're always aware of what it is you're actually buying. So the point of this is we're trying to help ensure that there's going to continue to be innovation, but that you are paying for that innovation at a reasonable cost.
And that works right into the next guest, Kim Baldwin, a McPherson, Kansas producer on sorghum utilization.
Sorghum is utilized in a lot of different areas. And one thing that I'm really thankful for is the versatility of it. You know, for us, we have ethanol plants that we can easily send our sorghum to in central Kansas. But there's some really cool emerging markets and opportunities for sorghum and sorghum producers from, you know, the pet food industry, obviously human food and that food industry, aquaculture. So it's not necessarily just something that you feed the hogs or the cows, you know, as part of their ration anymore. There's just a lot of opportunities, and I'm just excited that, you know, there are potential markets that are going to be including some sorghum.
With all the challenges, though, is she optimistic?
Well, we farm, so we have to be optimistic, right, Tony? Yes, I am very optimistic. You know, sorghum hits a lot of those check marks in if we're talking sustainability. You know, in taking a look at how industry and customers are looking at sustainable solutions, I think sorghum can be fit into a lot of those solutions, whether it's, a sustainable beef or, you know, ethanol, whatever that is. Sorghum, just because it requires less resources, checks those boxes. And so I'm incredibly excited to see what's next for sorghum.
It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
It is a thrill to be back here. I've been to Texas a few times here. I visited a few producers, farmers and ranchers, and I have a great affinity for Texas.
House Ag Committee holding a Farm Bill listening session in Waco, Texas. Florida Congresswoman Kat Kamick.
I grew up in Colorado on a small cow-calf operation. I rodeoed my whole life. My claim to fame is I was the mutton busting champion in Colorado for the state. And after that, I barrel raced for a very long time, but not well. You know, representing a district in Florida is really incredible because we not only have 300 specialty crops, we're like three states put into one. And so we have the full gamut from timber to dairy, equine to peanuts, watermelon, blueberries. I think actually this year we'll produce 25% of the market share in the United States of blueberries. We really cover it all. And so I'm really honored to represent not just my district, but the state of Florida on the Ag Committee. So this is really important, not just to my district, but to our state and, of course, the country. You know, last year I was really excited to lead on the waiver, the livestock waiver. Someone mentioned the electronic logs and the reset. To me, that's just common sense. Because in a state like Texas, in a state like Florida, if you're in Okeechobee, you're 8 hours, you ain't even out of the state yet. And for those of us that are Southerners, we know how hot it gets. And when you're trying to haul up into Kansas or Nebraska or Colorado, that just doesn't make sense. So I'm really focused on common sense solutions. And a lot of times those are bipartisan solutions. So I think there's a lot of work we can be doing. For me, I'm also honored to serve on the Energy and Commerce Committee. So I get the 1-2 punch on the EPA. Watch out. I have a particular distaste for regulations because as someone who grew up in agriculture, I knew what those regulations were doing. While they may sound great in theory in Washington, there is no swamp creature or bureaucrat in the basement somewhere in Washington that knows better than us out here in the fields. So addressing regulatory reform, I know there's a lot of labor concerns and really bringing down input costs. I know how hard it's been. I hear it every single day. One of the things that I've heard talked about here today is broadband, and of course we're moving into an era of precision agriculture. I have never been more excited, Mr. Chairman, than when I got to drive a See & Spray. Have you been on one of those things? That is awesome. I mean, that is the kind of technology that is going to revolutionize agriculture, not just in our country, but around the world. And then you think about what AI is going to do in introducing an entire new set of tools for our farmers and ranchers and give that next generation an opportunity, a bite at the apple. That's my food pun for the day. I think by and large what you're hearing here today is that advocacy is key. We have a lot of work ahead of us, and I tell this to people all over the country. 25% of your job is advocacy. It doesn't matter what title you have. It doesn't matter what industry you are in. 25% of your time is advocacy, because if there's one thing I have learned about Washington and people in Washington, it's that you don't know what you don't know. And so no one knows this industry better than you. Thank you for being here today. Thank you for sharing your insights. But we need you to continue the fight and help educate so many more up in Washington, because while we will put together an awesome product under the leadership of Mr. Thompson,
it's Agriculture Today.
This is Agriculture Today.
One final issue, the importance of a productive working relationship between Congress and the technical experts at USDA as we develop the Farm Bill.
Arkansas Senator John Bozeman, the ranking member of the Senate Ag Committee, expressing frustration with Ag Secretary Tom Vilsack on Thursday at a Senate Ag Committee oversight hearing of USDA.
Senator Stabenow and I are proud of the accomplishments that we made in the last Congress. And in every instance where we've been successful, we've experienced constructive and timely technical feedback from USDA. The Keep Kids Fed Act, providing support for summer meals for children, and the Growing Climate Solutions Act, which Senator Braun led, are examples. Senator Braun and Senator Stabenow led are examples of the great things we accomplished with USDA providing invaluable technical assistance. I am growing increasingly concerned about USDA's ability to provide timely responses, however. Just yesterday, I received a response to a letter I wrote to you in October, which was not entirely responsive. We really depend on USDA as we write the Farm Bill because we need to understand how the policies we're considering would be implemented. We very much enjoy working with your staff, but again, the lack of responsiveness lately has been disappointing. And it's not only from me, it's from members on our side of the aisle, and a lot of this is actually inquiries that are bipartisan inquiries. So it's something that I'd like for you to look at and see if we can resolve because it really is going to be a key factor as we head into the Farm Bill.
Vilsack expressing a bit of frustration as well.
Make no mistake, you folks have a very difficult job, a very difficult job. Crafting a Farm Bill is not an easy task, and it's particularly difficult in this day and age. I want to assure Senator Bozeman that we will provide timely and effective technical assistance. I would ask of you, Senator, and your colleagues, that when you make requests for information, that you really just simply target what you really want and not provide a laundry list of things that could be considered to be somewhat of a fishing expedition. I think that will help us be more helpful to you in providing technical assistance.
Bozeman not quite finished trying to remind the secretary that oversight belongs to Congress.
The comment that I made, getting technical assistance and the answer to simple questions, you all don't get to decide what is a fishing expedition. We have the right to ask questions. We've got 50 outstanding questions. We've got a bunch of technical assistance that people are trying to write bills from. And again, we simply aren't getting the information.
Well, I don't think that is a fair evaluation, Senator, of the work that we've done over the last 2 years to try to be responsive to concerns that you've expressed. For example, you expressed concerns about a situation in Dumas, Arkansas, and our team has worked.
And you did a wonderful job.
Well, and that's an example of us willing to work with you when there is a need and an issue. And we're more than happy to provide the information that you need to craft a bill, to improve a bill, to determine whether or not a provision should be included in a bill.
Well, I'll be glad to make the list of the 50. And again, it's not me. It's us. And I would say that I have to speak for themselves, but both sides are having this problem.
It's Agriculture Today.
You're listening to Agriculture Today.
Retained placenta typically is when we have got the fetal membranes that didn't become unattached and actually pass on after the birth of the calf by 24 hours.
Dr. Mark Johnson, Oklahoma State Beef Cattle Breeding Specialist on retained placenta cases during calving.
Typically, that placenta gets shed within 8 hours of calving, and that's pretty normal. So if we're seeing it there for a few days post-calving, what are the potential problems we get into? It is not the placenta itself that's the issue, but it is the fact that it's still attached inside the uterus that leads to potential uterine infections. We've got a cow actually defecating down onto that, the manure, the microorganisms in the manure potentially having a pathway into the uterus. When she lays down, the bacteria in the dirt has a means to get into the uterus. Now, this can potentially cause some serious infections. The cow may become ill. She may start to lose weight. We may need to seek immediate treatment. In severe cases, this can even be lethal for a cow, but rarely that happens. More likely occurrence is that long-term, this cow doesn't clean up, repair herself, and isn't quite ready to breed back as soon as she needs to in order to turn around and calve within 12 months. We usually find the long-term repercussions of retained placenta with cows that are later to get bred or potentially come up open whenever we're preg checking in the fall. So, what are our potential causes? Well, long-term, if we've had inadequate energy protein supplementation during pregnancy and cows are calving too thin, this can lead to a nutritional problem there. There's other vitamin and mineral deficiencies that can lead to retained placenta. The two most common things that we track it to is a lack of vitamin A and a lack of the vitamin selenium. The other big thing that causes retained placenta is just a prolonged, or let's just say dystocia. We have prolonged calving. This problem can become exaggerated as a result of cows that are a little thin and poor going into calving. But anything that causes difficult birth and dystocia, a calf that's too big, an abnormal presentation, maybe she's trying to give birth to twins. If it causes a problem of calving, wears the cow out, we're more likely to see retained placenta. There are diseases that can lead to retained placenta. Something like lepto, brucellosis can all lead into retained placenta. So typically, what are our best management practices to avoid this? Make sure our cows are calving at a body condition score 5 to 6. make sure our heifers are calving at a body condition score 6. In that case, they're strong enough, charged up enough, that just being worn out through the calving process should not lead to extended amount of time actually giving birth to the calf. Vitamin and mineral supplementation can be really important, making sure we got an adequate amount of vitamin A and selenium in that ad-lib fed mineral can be a real important long-term solution to avoiding retained placenta. And proper herd health, obviously. So if we're seeing retained placenta in our cows and we need to address it, if we've got some immediate sickness or problem there, we need to consult our veterinarian. Why is it more of a significant issue this year, potentially? In a year that we have been more likely than not to have fed some non-traditional hays, hays that might not have been as green and leafy as what they have been in years past. What is the primary source of vitamin A in a cow's diet? Green, leafy vegetation. So non-traditional hays, maybe a long-term lack of vitamin A in the diet, could have led to some potential issues this year.
Learn more online, sunup.okstate.edu. It's Agriculture Today.
Ag News Now. Agriculture Today.
You know, this farm bill, if you exclude conservation, which is 5% of the farm bill, and if you exclude nutrition, which is very important to me, I was the chair of the nutrition subcommittee in the last farm bill, that's 8%. We wind up with 0.2% of 1% is what we invest in the farm bill.
The chairman of the House Ag Committee is from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson. He was speaking recently at a House Ag Committee listening session, a farm bill listening session in Waco, Texas.
If you put the rest of that together, it's a total of 2% of total spending. And so it is about food security. And I know, and we know, that you're, as farmers, American farmers, you're facing a lot of headwinds. We heard about inflation, diesel fuel, input costs, availability of certain crop protection tools for food and fiber. I mean, there's just a lot right now that's making it difficult. We will be, we had our very first hearing on that issue, because that's the landscape of 2023 as we write this farm bill. It was to show us and to hear from witnesses, and I thought we had great witnesses sitting next to one of them, you know, that really laid out the landscape of where American farmers are today, those hardworking families that provide us our food, our fiber, our building materials, our energy resources, all those things. And so we will be advancing some legislation to be able to deal with those headwinds through the Agriculture Committee here in the not-too-distant future, something we had started last year, but we're going to put that forward. You know, American agriculture productivity is amazing. It has increased 287% since the 1940s. 287%. Now, with inflation, it's dropped down to 279. That happens with high costs and high inflation. But we're going to put together a farm bill that we put the programs in place to where we can drive that that productivity to 400% by the year 2035. And we can do that. We have great momentum coming out of the 117th Congress. We've got leadership, which is very in the House, which is probably more supportive of the farm bill than any time in my experience. We have what we call the Four Corners, which includes myself, Ranking Member Scott from Atlanta, Georgia, a good friend of mine, close friend of mine. We have Senator Stabenow, who chairs on the Senate side, and Senator Bozeman from Arkansas. And we finished the year really strong. You heard about the rice fix that we did. We did a chronic wasting disease bill that all these got to the president's desk at the end of the year. I wish they'd have gotten to the president's desk a little sooner, but there's this little thing about you got to work with the Senate. So still figuring them out. But we got a lot done. We did the Sustains Act, which will allow us to take private contributions, creates a public-private partnership with USDA to help fund more conservation programs using, you know, contributions basically for businesses, corporations, businesses of all sizes that want to get their climate credentials. They want to be seen as climate-friendly, green, sustainable, whatever word works for them in their marketing. And they can do that by helping the people that are truly the climate heroes of the world, and that's the American farmer.
Chairman of the House Ag Committee from Pennsylvania, G.T. Thompson. It's Agriculture Today.
With Agriculture Today, here's Tony St. James.
There are really two end games here. One's pretty tangible. There's significant reductions we can make in greenhouse gases. We think it's north of 50 million metric tons. We think we can reach millions of acres, 25 million acres of working lands in the United States. And we think the model of this is a commodity program. It's about supporting the production of climate-smart commodities. We think that's all important.
Undersecretary for Farm Production and Conservation, Robert Bonney.
There's an intangible outcome here, which is we want to build a model, a voluntary, incentive-based, collaborative model that works with farmers, ranchers, and forest owners that we think will work here domestically, and we think it could work internationally. We want to demonstrate that agriculture can be a hero when it comes to climate change. That's a little less numbers-oriented than, thinking about acres and tons, but ultimately that's what we want to do.